Welcome to CHOATS Enforcement and Investigations Updates, a podcast series hosted by our Government Enforcement and Compliance Group. On this show, we discuss timely analysis of legal and compliance developments, court decisions, and changes in legislation and regulations related to white-collar defense, global investigations, and whistleblower claims.
I'm Christine Savage, and today my colleague Mark McPherson and I will talk about two recent enforcement actions in the research security space, both as a reminder that the government continues to make these matters a priority, and to offer some insights and takeaways from these matters that you can use for your own institution's research security program.
Thanks, Christine. As you likely know, many research security enforcement matters of the last 5 years have centered on malign foreign talent programs and undisclosed foreign support for research. And one of the two cases we'll discuss today fits into that category with a couple of twists. The other case is a bit of a departure in a few key respects. First, the case is really at its heart an export control case. And second, it's a case that developed from a self-disclosure by a biotech company who discovered wrongdoing by one of its employees, which then led to an investigation of individuals and activities at the University of Florida. That case also marks the first time that a company has been rewarded for its cooperation with a declination for export control violations from the DOJ's National Security Division under its voluntary self-disclosure program. So, Christine, focusing first on the export controls case, can you describe the basic contours of the scheme and how the University of Florida became involved?
At a high level, the scheme was designed by an individual who had no affiliation with the university, and he was looking to ship various drugs and toxins. They were described as including non-contagious proteins of cholera or pertussis, the toxin that can lead to whooping cough, as well as analytical samples of controlled substances, including fentanyl, MDMA, cocaine, and methamphetamine, all of which this person wanted to ship to China. These are, not surprisingly, substances that are subject to federal export controls, and in some cases, their shipment requires either an export license or specific disclosures about the end user, and that's particularly the case when it's shipped to someplace like China. So this individual, in order to avoid getting a license or revealing what he was planning to ship, recruited a number of people to help him illegally ship these materials to China. One of those people that he recruited was an employee of a chemical biotech company, Sigma Aldrich. And that person helped him process orders knowing that they weren't legitimate. Another participant was an employee of the University of Florida who worked in a research laboratory stockroom. And in that role, that individual helped place orders, by the way, at a discount that was only available to places like the university. And then he delivered the packages when they arrived to the ringleader, who would then repackage them and ship them to China, of course, lying about both what was being shipped and how much of it was in any particular package. Added on to that, there were a number of university students who were recruited to use their email addresses to communicate with the biotech company or to allow the stockroom employee to list their name and email address in order to facilitate orders. Again, all helping this outsider hide who was actually ordering or receiving these materials. The students were paid in gift cards to places like Home Depot and Target. Sometimes they were paid in trips. Some of them were given loans from the ringleader. And then finally, the names and email addresses of some former university researchers also were used on orders in order to make them appear legitimate. So a lot of different players, but really an outsider co-opting a number of people within sort of the university environment in order to further his scheme.
Yeah, so perhaps unsurprisingly, I understand there's a number of criminal pleas tied to that case. So what's the scope of the crimes and what were the pleas about?
So in the end, this scheme went on for close to 7 years undetected and resulted in the shipment of thousands of samples of dangerous drugs and toxins to China, worth millions of dollars. And both the ringleader and the former biotech company employee have now pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit wire fraud charges. And both of them could face jail time and fines when they're sentenced later this summer. That said, both have offered to cooperate with the government to help identify other parties that were involved in the scheme. And it's expected that they therefore may receive some leniency with regard to their sentences. But we won't know more until August or September when that happens.
Okay. Well, it feels like you could probably extract some potential compliance lessons learned or maybe checklist items from this case. So what has this made you think about, or how might you advise a client who's looking to avoid this kind of situation?
Yeah, there really are a number of possible takeaways for universities or academic medical centers based on this case. And in thinking through, in particular, how might the university have caught on to this misconduct on its own or earlier in the process? I think there's a number of security control questions that arise. Just for example, you know, do we have, or how up to date is our database of authorized researchers or laboratories who are able to order supplies? And I say that because here there were orders that went through despite the fact that the researcher identified as being the one who was requesting the materials didn't even work at the university anymore. So the two former researchers whose names were used had left the university in 2015. And yet there were orders placed in their names as late as 2023. So that raises the question of, is there a way to enhance the purchase order system to make sure that only current employees could be listed on an order form? Second, if there's a student that's tied to a purchase order or request, are we confirming that that order makes sense based on where that student is studying, what school they're in, what their area of focus is. Again, in this case, one of the students involved changed her email signature to suggest she was a biomedical engineering student when in fact she was a business finance major. And in another instance, the ringleader offered to pay the wife of the stockroom employee to register as a student of the university simply so he could use her email address to try and process more orders. So they're putting in controls who limit who can place an order that's tied to something more than just a working university email address might help tackle that problem. In this case, there actually was an auto reply that got returned when they were trying to place orders under the names of the former researchers. It didn't preclude the orders from going through. It just sort of confirmed to them, this person isn't around and isn't going to sort of get forwarded the email or sent questions about what it is that they're ordering because they're gone. There you might look at, is there an opportunity to use a drop-down menu for online orders to eliminate the possibility of selecting a former employee? And that might have made it at least more difficult for someone to pull off this type of scheme. Third area of controls might say, if a specific type of material, so a hazardous material, a toxin, a controlled substance like methamphetamine, for example, if that's being ordered, how many times is it being ordered? And does that trigger a red flag sort of in the ordering system? Or do you require a second level approval for something like that, a department chair, somebody who is going to look at those types of orders with a more critical eye? And then lastly, I think about sort of what security do you have in place in laboratory stock rooms? Are there signature or other requirements that can be put in place so that only authorized individuals are retrieving packages? Badge access requirements, cameras, or other monitoring systems that might have identified the fact that there were at times 30, 40 boxes of materials coming into the stockroom and then almost immediately being taken out by the stockroom employee to be delivered, to a parking lot at a mall an hour away to be given to somebody who had no connection with the university. Could they have better controlled what was going in and out of the organization? So those are the sort of takeaways that I take from this case. But Mark, let's shift gears a little bit. Let's talk about sort of one of the more traditional, I would say, research security cases that was resolved earlier this year. So back in May, the Cleveland Clinic entered into a settlement agreement with DOJ over alleged failures to disclose information in grant applications. Can you talk a little bit about what the allegations were and how the case ultimately settled?
Sure. So Cleveland Clinic settled with the government for $7.6 million, $3.8 million of which was restitution over conduct related to three NIH grants, all which involved the same principal investigator. So the issue was alleged false statements and grant submissions to NIH between 2013 and 2020, specifically statements about the PI's foreign grant support and affiliation with a foreign institution. So these submissions were made through ERA Commons, which is NIH's official grant submission portal. And it's alleged that at least some of the false submissions were made by others who used the PI's username and password. The settlement also imposed some specific award conditions. And I'll note that Cleveland Clinic did not admit wrongdoing as part of the settlement.
So is this case related to the criminal case that was brought against a Cleveland Clinic researcher a few years back?
It is. The PI in question here was arrested in May of 20 and then fired from Cleveland Clinic the same day after he was with the institution for about 21 years. He was charged with making false statements and wire fraud stemming from that exact same conduct, which is the alleged failure to disclose his position with and grant support from the foreign institution. In that case, the government claimed that there was research overlap between the Foreign Funding Agency and NIH, meaning that NIH was allegedly paying for research already funded by someone else. But in July of 21, DOJ dropped the case without really providing any explanation as to why.
So I think we know probably around July 2021 was when a number of these cases, I think DOJ decided just not to pursue them, maybe more for political reasons rather than the substance of whether or not somebody had a violation. But I'm really interested in, you mentioned that there were specific award conditions imposed as part of this settlement. Can you talk a little bit about what those are and how common is it that a False Claims Act settlement would include that type of conditions?
Sure. NIH can require these specific award conditions in certain circumstances, including when it feels that grant terms aren't complied with. So first, Cleveland Clinic has to complete a corrective action plan, which isn't terribly remarkable. And that involves assessing internal controls surrounding other support, foreign component reporting, implementing a training program on other support, research security, cybersecurity, things like that, and completing an internal, an improvement plan for internal controls to ensure, you know, institutional oversight over disclosing true, complete, and accurate information to NIH. The second part, which is more unusual in my experience, is this imposition of a requirement that a high-level official personally attest to the truth, completeness, and accuracy of all other grant support info submitted to NIH, and that's will last for a year or until NIH is satisfied, according to the settlement.
So that certainly raises a question about what's the risk to that certifying official who needs to complete that attestation. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think it potentially does present risk for the individual. The issue is that institutions really don't have much of a choice but to rely on researchers to disclose what their own affiliations or support are. And it would take a lot of resources to try to figure that out yourself, either by independently reviewing each individual's disclosures or trying to find open source data on affiliations, which really isn't as plentiful as it once was. And even then, I don't think you could be certain that you had all that information before signing that kind of attestation. And plus, many of these grants fraud cases are based on false statements. So, hopefully this is an unlikely scenario, but it does seem to present some personal risk to the individual who ends up signing. But I think these attestations will be based on a series of probably sub-attestations from department administrators, PIs, maybe others, and then sort of bolstered by demonstrating that the PIs received training on what it is they're supposed to do.
So it sounds like maybe something akin to a CIA sub-certification process where the person who's ultimately going to make the certification certifies that they're relying on a bunch of other certifications underneath it in order to be able to make the statement.
I think that's right. I don't think there's much of an option otherwise.
So looking at the settlement number itself, it looks like it works out to a 2x multiplier. And there's no language in the settlement agreement to suggest that cooperation credit was given. The settlement does, however, reference that they expect future cooperation. What can we sort of take away from these components of the settlement agreement?
Yeah, you know, a 2 multiplier is a little bit high. It's a bit over the average for these types of settlements. You know, interestingly, when the researcher was arrested back in 2020, Cleveland Clinic gave a statement saying that they were fully cooperating with DOJ and that they had terminated the employee after an internal review. Then after the settlement this year, they gave a statement saying that they were surprised that DOJ chose to pursue the matter, knowing that it had worked with NIH and the U.S. Attorney's Office on the issue. And, you know, of course, we aren't privy to why the U.S. Attorney's Office took this approach with Cleveland Clinic. You know, I think it highlights the importance of earning cooperation credit in cases where settlement seems likely. And according to DOJ guidance, that involves things like being transparent, fronting bad facts when the situation warrants, like providing key documents proactively, acknowledging responsibility, things like that. On the future cooperation point, the settlement agreement requires Cleveland Clinic to turn over all its non-privileged information about its internal review. And that could mean that DOJ or the funding agencies aren't finished with this case and are still considering action against individuals.
So one just sort of last question or point. You noted in describing sort of the underlying conduct included the fact that passwords to the ERA common system had been shared inappropriately. Can you talk a little bit about that feature? Because I think that does have sort of compliance implications that institutions should be thinking about.
Right. Yeah. So the settlement involved conduct where someone other than the PI submitted these grant documents using the PI's username and password for ERA Commons. And unsurprisingly, NIH prohibits that, prohibits password, now passphrase sharing. Somewhat relatedly, and this wasn't the case at the time of this conduct, but as of fiscal year 2023, NIH added this provision to the grant's policy statement requiring each researcher to personally attest to their own info and biosketches, other support, etc. And I think really the message here is that NIH wants its researchers, you know, on the hook for certifying that their own information is truthful, accurate, and complete, and attempts to skirt those requirements are ill-advised.
Yeah, I think both of us have seen a number of situations where researchers in the past have sort of delegated that task to an administrator in their group, and then where there have been discrepancies between their actual support and the support that was listed, they then try to sort of pass the blame on to the administrator or say that that wasn't something they're responsible for. So I guess this is clearly an indication from the government that they take the personal attestation piece of this seriously. And, you know, if you share the password to have somebody else enter the information on your behalf, that's not going to fly moving forward.
I think that's exactly right.
Well, thanks, Mark. We hope that this has been useful for those of you in the research security and compliance space, and we'll keep you apprised of additional case developments as we learn of them.
Thanks, everyone.
The information presented in this recording is for educational purposes only. It does not constitute legal advice for a specific situation. If you wish to obtain legal advice, you should retain an attorney and explain the facts of your particular situation.